Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Unlike so many of the people who sit in front of me here who played football, many of whom grew up in Scottish mining villages, you grew up not just in the south of France, but near in and around Saint-Tropez. What was life like as a child?
In and around, yes.
Yeah. Not in?
You know, the other thing when you grow up in such an environment is you don't have to worry much about the future, because you've got the sunshine, you've got a beautiful setup, sceneries are just amazing, and all year long, actually, is from, you know, people are, when they ask me the question, David, where are you from? They said, I'm saying, yeah, I was born in Saint-Tropez, and, Saint-Tropez, you mean party and things like that? I say, well, you know, it's a fisherman village, basically. Is 4,500 people living there all year long. Obviously, we got 180,000 in the summer. But the rest of the year is just brilliant.
You seem like a very relaxed person. Is that entirely down to your own personality, or is it growing up in that environment?
I think it's just growing up in, you know, we've got a song in the south of France saying, the sun makes you lazy. And it's very difficult after, if you want to be a footballer or something in sports, to really push yourself really hard to get there. The beginning, you know, you're so focused on the things you like in life, like playing football was my main thing when I was a kid, and that's it. I mean, when I talk to my dad, even these days, he's telling me, you know, even when you were 8, 9, 10 years old, you were different. Different attitude in life towards the school, different attitude towards football. I was watching the other kids and you were just amongst them. But you were different. You were different. You were acting different in your preparation. We could picture it out really properly, that you were aiming and for something. Your goal in your head, in your mind, was very clear. And it was unusual, because most of the kids, they don't think about being footballers in the south of France. And I'm talking about back in the 80s, and because it was probably more complicated to find a professional club. But you know what? Having said that, I love living in London, but, you know, going down in the south of France is quite... In London, you live, you're fast, and you go there and there, and you got traffic, and you go boom. South of France is more relaxed.
Tell me about your family.
Family is very, very simple. Simple is not probably the word to use. My dad was working in the Marines. My mom was working for FT. FT is France Telecom, like, yeah. BT, British, yeah. Telecom. Working hard, got only 5 weeks holidays per year, not big wage, you know, monthly wage, it wasn't great, but my parents, you know, really emphasized the fact that with the two kids, I've got my brother, Sebastian, is 4 years younger than me, and we are just enjoying ourselves, didn't miss anything in our life. We were well treated and well educated, and it was wonderful. It was wonderful. Unfortunately, I left home when I was 13 and a half, so I went to boarding school and I left my brother. So when we talk about it these days, we miss the very important years as a teenager, when you build something just up with your brother, and, you know, when from 13 to 18, this is the crucial time for brothers to get involved in other things than just, you know, kicking a ball in the backyard of the house. So it's, we both miss that actually, and this is a big miss in my life because when you're 13 and a half, 14, 15, whatever, you don't think about that. You don't think about relationship with your brother. You say, oh, you got your life in front of you and you don't really care about that. But when you reach 30, 40 years old, you realize how important it is to be close to your family.
David, or David, I don't know where I'm going to settle with that. Talk to me about your early years in French football, because you're not, if I might be so bold, an instant success. You play for Toulon, then you play for Racing Matra, then you play for Brest. What do you remember about your early years of your football career?
It was a very complicated start, actually, because I grew up quite late around, when I say grew up, and I... You know, I was very tiny, very small. And when I was 16, I realized that my life would be difficult if I want to carry on in football, in the game. But I managed to grow up and to, you know, I was taller and stronger. And
filled out, as we say in English.
Yes, and definitely. And in Nice, people, they said to my dad, listen, Mr. Ginola, well, actually, because I was doing my A-level, I didn't have time to train properly with the team in Nice. So they haven't seen me much in training, but they knew that I was a very interesting and good player. But they said, oh, listen, Mr. Ginola, we not offer your son a contract with the academy because we don't think he's going to be a professional anyway. So my dad came out from the office and I look at him and I say, what did they say? And they say, well, let's go. Let's go in the car. We go. I say, well, where are we going? I say, we go back home. And I say, they say they don't want me at the club. And they say, no, they don't want you at the club. And I was very surprised because obviously I'd have to end up my studying and I thought they would give me a chance, and they didn't. So I have to bounce back, and I have an offer to do a training session, a try in a club, actually next door in Toulon. And in Toulon, I arrive in Toulon, and I have a 4 or 5 days try with the club, and straight away the guy look at me and he say, oh, this kid is different. So he put two red lines under my name. He wanted to sign me straight away, so I did sign, and it was amazing because from that moment I realized in my life that this is it. This is an opportunity. This is a proper opportunity to do what I always wanted to do in my life, is playing football. And I did it. I mean, I trained very hard. I was waking up in the morning with only one thing in mind, is becoming David, you have to become a professional football player, and this is it. I dream about it when I was 9 years old. I even write an essay saying I wanted to be a football player. And 10 years later, actually, I did it. And I signed when I was 19. I started to play with the first team. I was with Franck Leboeuf, sharing the same room in the academy. It was a shame because he didn't play at the time. And when they needed me in the first team, they went, they said, David, you have to change your training and, you know, habits on a daily basis. So you have to move from the room. So I have to say to Frank that I'm going to link in the room by myself because we didn't share the same training time. So it was a bit of a shame. But in the other hand, I really succeed in that. And I start to play in the first season. I thought it would have been just a couple of games and actually play more than that.
So you play for a couple of years for Toulon, and then you move to Paris, but not to PSG, to another club.
Mr. Lagardère is a very big industrial man. He's got a huge company in France and across the world. Decided he was involved in Formula One. He decided to go into football, but I think it wasn't done properly. But we had some great players, probably the best squad probably ever made until today in Paris with Ibrahimovic and all those players. But it was just amazing. We had Francescoli and Lidbarski and all internationals, and we were playing 11 against 11, and it was that both teams could play in the Premier League in France. So it was difficult because I was just 20. I was doing my service for the army, so I spent a year doing my services. So
you did national service, yeah?
Yeah. So I mean, every morning at 7, I was on the square with my outfit, and I have to see the flag.
Tell me about your haircut in the army.
Oh, I got the long hair, and when I arrived at the army with my long hair, I remember the face of the hairdresser. He looked at me and he said, "Oh, I think I'm going to enjoy that."
You shaved all your hair off?
Everything.
Oh.
Everything. So
did you like being in the army?
Well, right at the time, because I have to do we call it in France the classes. We have 3 weeks. And during the 3 weeks, you have been treated like any other boys there.
Yeah.
Rather than after the 3 weeks, because of the games and everything, I was playing as a professional.
Yeah.
You are treated differently, and they call the Bataillon Joinville. It's like a sports. You got rugby players, footballers, athletes. You got all different kind of sports people, and you got special treatment in terms of how they manage your week.
Sure.
If you got a game on Wednesday, Saturday, obviously you're not coming back to the barracks, but I did everything. I mean, I was there. I remember one story. I was playing for Matra. We were playing a game in Strasbourg. It was a midweek game. We played there. And I had a fantastic game. I scored. The game was on TV. And I went back with a private plane with the team to the Bourget. Le Bourget. I went back home, and it was roughly 2 o'clock in the morning. 2 o'clock in the morning, I arrived there. My girlfriend, which is my wife now, she said, "David, I got a phone call from the army. They want you back right now." And I said, "Are you kidding? We just play a game, and it was a tough one. I played 90 minutes. I'm very knackered. I mean, I can't go back." I said, "Yes, they want you back right now." So I took my car, went back. It was 80 or 90 miles away, so I have to travel down. I arrived there, and I saw all my friends wearing the army suits with the bags, the rucksack, ready to go. And I said, "What are you doing?" And I saw the captain. I said, "Captain," and he looked at me and said, "Oh, David, by the way, great free kick tonight." And I said, "But listen, can you just tell me, because I was at home, I've been told to come back to the place." And he said, "David, we're going for a march for 10 kilometers in the woods, back and forth, in the middle of the night,
yeah,
with the compass, and all the guns and everything.
All the gear.
In the dark, in the middle of the winter, it was -5 in Fontainebleau." And I'm telling you, that's probably something, obviously, I will remember all my life, because after the 10 kilometers, it was 6 in the morning, I was against the tree, in my really big coat, and I fell asleep against the tree. They woke me up, and I shake, and I
your teeth were chattering
all morning. it was just like, what are you? And they say David, it's good for you, it's the warm down, you're doing your warm down of the game.
David, you say you played from Racing Matra. You said they had a great team, but they got relegated in 1990.
Yeah, but that's the paradox. It's difficult to say, because my first day in training, I was sitting in a dressing room. I was 20 years old. I was looking around. It was all internationals, players I was watching on TV. And I said, "Oh, my God, oh, what am I doing here?" And I start to play, and I play 36 games. I play a lot of games during this season, in the first season, while people were thinking about other players. But Arthur Georges was also involved in Paris after that. Gave me a lot of credits, and he thought I was a really interesting player, very good. So it was really, really good. Matra was an opportunity, but unfortunately, no bonding in a dressing room, nothing much as a partnership, and it was not the kind of atmosphere I really expected in a dressing room.
After they went down, you moved to another club, Brest, and they also got relegated the following year in 1991, but that was a very different thing, because you finished sixth but were relegated, and you became the club lawyer.
Yeah, that's very funny, because the year before we've been relegated, but we played the final of the French Cup with Matra.
With Matra, yeah.
Moved to Brest, arrived there, great first season, bunch of very young talents, very, very good team, and we end up the season with... in sixth position, it was really good. I mean, we were playing great football, playing for fun, nothing to worry about, actually, nothing to lose. And but at the end, we've been relegated because of the financial problem in the club. And we have the financial fair play in France already in place. We
talk even about then.
Yes, even
right,
then.
Okay.
We always have these sort of things.
So this is where Platini has picked it up from.
Yes,
yeah.
This is very important in France that the clubs are money-wise managed well, so that's why we've been relegated. So it was unfortunate and it was a bit of a shame, because we felt we don't have a job, and you know, the people in the office they didn't, so we have to fight back. But we realized that the club was for sale, and they wanted to sell the club to another, to an investor, but the investor didn't want to put any money. He wanted to buy the club as it was for one franc, French franc, but he wanted to use the money coming from the selling of the players to put the money in the club. I said, no, we're going to do it differently. So this is when I started to be involved, to get involved in the sabotage of the club. And it's and it was really a nightmare, because I realized at 22 years old that I was involved in something that I wouldn't want. First of all, this was not my place. You know what I mean? But in a way, I needed to do something for my fellow professional in the club. So this is exactly what I did. So I went to a tribunal. I defend most of the players. And it was like it was just a big mess. So finally, we arrived at the final decision. And the judge looked at me. She was a woman. She looked at me with a nice smile, deep in my eyes. She looked at me and said, "Mr. Ginola, thanks very much." I was 22. I was facing most of the people from the law, and she said, "Okay, the club is not for sale. You got 1 year as a professional club left. You, most of the professional in the club, you are free to go anywhere you go." And it was like a relief from every single one of us, and from the youngest to us. And we all left the club. We could sell ourselves to the best clubs around. And I got some very, very interesting témoignage letters of players saying, "They thank you very much. You save us from this really big problem, big trouble." And they went to play for Monaco, for Auxerre, for different clubs. And I realized at 22 that I was already involved in things that I wouldn't want to.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule.
It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
David, so having been a 22-year-old lawyer and got yourself free of the contract that was a problem, you join a club that I think is going to very soon dominate European football, PSG in Paris. But I think it's a very different club in those days.
It was a different club because it was a start of a new era in Paris, actually, for Paris Saint-Germain. New sponsor, new owner, Canal+. Big broadcaster, became the biggest broadcaster for sports in France. And at the time, so I had actually opportunities to sign in the best clubs in the country because I earned my first cap with Brest as a French player. And it was the most amazing news I heard back then when you play within a small club and you realize you received a call from Michel Platini and they said, I'm going to pick you in a team for the next game. And it was really interesting. So when I signed for Paris, I was already seen as the future of the club, a new, really good talent for the French, for French football. And so Arthur Georges was in charge of Paris Saint-Germain, the manager I had. He was my manager back in Matra Racing. So he said, David Ginola is my priority. So I went to see Bernard Tapie with Marseille. I went to see Campora for Monaco, Alain Flelou from Bordeaux, all the best club in France back then. And I decided to join Paris and because I thought overall the all the opportunities to work on my football, to think about my future was the best place to be. And I signed for the club and I think it was fantastic because all through the 4 years, we won absolutely everything. The French League, the two French Cup, one League Cup. We played three different semi-final of European Cups.
Three different tournaments, yeah.
Three different tournaments, UEFA.
Cup Winners Cup.
Cup Winners Cup and Champions League. So, and every year we lost against Arsenal once in semi-final. We lost against Juve, the second one, and we lost against AC Milan in the Champions League. So, but it was just amazing to play for Paris. Parc des Princes is fantastic.
As you say, PSG are tremendously successful. And off the back of that and as part of that, you're also building a career in the French national team.
Yeah.
A French national team that, as we come up to the World Cup in 94 in America, was already starting to take shape to become the world champions further down the line in 1998 back in France. And then we come to the latter qualifiers in 1993, the qualifiers for 1994, two famous games. I think they are almost infamous in French football history, and you're one of the central characters. France needed a couple of points to qualify for the World Cup in America. They managed to... Did you lose the home game against Israel? Yeah, you lost 3-2 to Israel. And then came that famous game against Bulgaria. You can tell me the details, but David, France did not qualify for the World Cup and you got blamed.
Well, we were two games in Paris. One against Israel. And winning against Israel, the meaning of this win would have been to play a match of gala, a gala game against Bulgaria. But
a lap of honour.
Exactly. And because I'm saying that because we won in Israel 4-1. And I don't want to say it would have been easy, but we look at it like as... It was very special because we enter in this game, we start to score. I assist the first one, I scored the second goal, and we were up in the game, and I was substitute, and we lost 3-2. So we realized everything will have been towards the final game of the competition and the group stage, and it was against Bulgaria in Paris, and we have to take 1 point. At least, and it was these final moments at the end of the game, free kick on the side, took the ball, crossed the ball, was a bit too long, and they got the ball in four passes. They went all the way up to our goal, and they strike and they score. So right at the end, so it was like a movie, like a very very intense and sad movie about actually all the group stage were not really nice. That was complicated. It was tough, and we didn't. We have such a great bunch of players.
Well, I should make the point. You had the basis of the team that went on to win the World Cup in 98, plus David Ginola, Eric Cantona, Jean-Pierre Papin, Frank Sauzet. I could go on.
Yeah.
We had an extraordinary good team,
yes.
France.
Yes, very good team.
When Emil Kostadinov put in that winner for Bulgaria, did you blame yourself?
I didn't play the game from the start. So I came on 20 minutes left in the game, and it was frustrating because I was top scorer in France. I was best player in the country, and I didn't start the game. So I was very frustrating not to be involved right from the beginning.
Sure.
So when you enter the game, we're talking about the game was in November. So in November, you're in full strength, your power is there, and you want to play every single game. And because I came on just for 20 minutes, you just want to prove every single time you've got the ball and you want to do something positive. And it was really, you want to create things, and it didn't work. So I didn't blame myself. I just blamed the entire thing, and you think about it, and it was a massive disappointment for every single one of us.
Now, look, I've survived England not qualifying for tournaments. And, of course, you know what the press is like here. It goes mad. But the reaction afterwards in France, but Gerard Houllier, the team went on to manage in this country, then the team manager. I mean, I don't know if these are good translations. But he said it was the most catastrophic scenario imaginable. He called you murderer. He said that you sent an Exocet missile through the heart of French football and committed a crime. I mean, it was incredible what happened to you, or at least with Houllier.
I think it was a killing process.
What do you mean?
I mean, you know, when you have a basket full of eggs, you have to pick the one with a crack on it. Huh? And they have to take one and say, well, do you know, they have to put the blame on someone. And I was the ideal
candidate
character,
yeah,
to be blamed, because I was doing things outside the game, like calendars. And, you know, I got, at the time, it wasn't any internet, so it was a 3615 Minitel.
Yeah, Minitel.
And I was doing a lot of things in France, and I think I was the perfect scapegoat at the time. And I realized it's funny because after the game, when we went back, because I was playing in Paris, my house was not far away from the stadium. And on the way back home, my wife was sitting next to me, and she said, I've got a very, very bad impression about, I think you're going to put the blame on you. Because after the game, we've seen some people, and she was talking to different people. And the next day, that's exactly what happened with this man saying these sort of things on me. And but I have to say, there was really, really complicated and difficult after that for me, because we played this game on the Wednesday, and the following Saturday I was playing a league game, and you know, obviously the league carry on, and
sure,
we have to play the games with Paris, and we're playing in Toulouse, and this game in Toulouse, I came and I was, as I said, top scorer in France, best player in the country. So when I arrived in Toulouse, and the club of Paris relied on me a lot, a lot. You know, George, we are myself up front.
Yeah.
So I didn't want to go, you know, before the game to see the grass and the pitch, how you're going to put the studs on and anything. So I said, no, I stay put. I stay in the dressing room. And Michel Denisot, the chairman, he came and said, no, David, go with the lads, go outside. And say, you sure you want to do that? And all the players were already on the pitch. So when I entered the pitch, it was like a big boo and whistle. And I realized, me, I always enter a football pitch to to give something back to the public, to the fans. Being treated like that, it was disgusting. So we start the game. But before that, I look at Michel Deschamps. I said, "You see what I told you? I don't want that. I don't want to hear that. I'm not that kind of person." So we start the game. After 10 minutes, the cross header, I scored my first goal. And I fell into tears because it was like too much to handle for me. It was too much. The entire week has been really complicated to manage for me. And at the time, I realized, well, it's probably time to do something else. You can stay in an environment where people are booing and whistling at you. You're not this kind of person. You want to give something good. So it happened, and it was the case for most of the games after that. And everywhere I've been, it was whistle and booing, and it was terrible. But I finally managed to score, carry on scoring goals, and at the end of this first, or this the same season,
93-94, yeah,
we won the French league. I was voted players player of the year, and I think it was the most important recognition for me, because I realized in a very, very, very bad, insecure environment, I managed to go through, to went through all this. And I remember the face of Michel Deniso looking at me at the time, and he said, "David, you are greater than you think, not just as a player, but as a man, because you have been through all this and you managed to go through all this with such great talent." I mean, it was, you never give up. You were just brilliant every single game for us. You respect all your teammates. You didn't do anything wrong, and I'm really feel sorry for what happened.
You played 10 more times for France, but I think your career was blighted by what happened against Bulgaria. France go on to win the World Cup in France in 1998 in a team that, I'll be honest, looking at the players who won it, brilliant team though it was, you should have been in that team. Talk to me about your feelings running up
well,
to the World Cup.
But that's always easy for a player to say, "I should have been in that team."
Sure.
But when you realize that you've been voted Players Player of the Year in 1999, and a year before you are not selected in the pre-selected in the 40 best players, you know, having a chance to play in the World Cup and being the final 22, I think it was nothing to do with football. It was just about the fact that they wanted to build a new era for French football with new players, and in the like of Zidane or players like that, and probably Henrik and myself, who are two big names to be picked in the squad. And I can understand that. But from the beginning, because we're talking about the World Cup in 1998, but don't forget that 2 years before it was the European Championship in England in 1996.
Sure.
And I was playing in England. The quarterfinal of the European Championship was at St. James Park. And they didn't even pick me up for this one too. So I think it was just the maneuver, the whole thing with I don't know what to say about it, but you know, right after the World Cup in 94, they selected me another few times. I played some games with the French national team, but I could feel that it wasn't really. It was such a big disappointment not to go to America, that people, they didn't really care about us anymore. They wanted to do something else, and I didn't feel really comfortable in that environment.
I mean, the most incredible thing, France wins the World Cup on its home soil in 98.
Yeah.
You went to the final?
I was there. I was in the stadium. I was working for the BBC, and I did the final. Obviously, I was right at the top of the Stade de France, and watching your fellow countrymen winning such a title, the most important competition in the game of football, it's just amazing. I start to talk, because we were on here, and I have to say, "Okay, what do you think is great for the country?"
Sure.
straight after that, I went back to my hotel, and I was probably the only one with my dad and my wife and my mom crying. And I was sitting on the floor in my room in Paris, watching TV, millions of people in the streets on the Champs-Élysées celebrating the win. And I was sitting there, I was talking to one of my friends. I was crying on the phone, and I say, what they have done to me. I mean, I was devastated. I couldn't endure anything, you know. And literally a few yards from me, people were just celebrating and drinking. And because I understand it was massive for the country, massive. You know, it was the second time in the entire century that we invaded the Champs-Élysées. It was for the armistice in 1945. And the second time was in 1998 for the World Cup. My game of football. And I wasn't there to celebrate with my family. So, and you know, I'm not the kind of person who are really, I'm not focused on myself. I was probably devastated because I wanted to see my dad, my son, in the shoulder of my dad. You know, I wanted them to be proud of me. And the most important thing these days is to have my son, he's 22, looking at some image and say, David, I know what you've been through, and you know, love you. You should have been there. You're the greatest. But somehow, I didn't achieve the final things I wanted to achieve, because it's nice to win or to earn accolades from people like players, player of the year. It's beautiful. It's a massive reward. But I wanted to play football to earn things collectively.
Yeah.
As a team, not as an individual.
Okay, well, let's leave your international career. Thank you for that aside for a moment. You have another good year after the famous year of 94. You have another good year with Paris Saint-Germain. And in the summer of 1995 comes a time to leave Paris. Because of your performances in the three semi-finals that Paris Saint-Germain have reached in successive European competitions, everyone assumed you'd be going to Barcelona or Real Madrid or one of those clubs. And you come to Newcastle.
Explain yourself,
Ginola.
But it's very simple. After the season 94-95, we played a quarterfinal against Barcelona in the Champions League, and Johan Cruyff was the manager. He wanted to sign me. I was his priority again, to be the player up front, Barcelona. But it was no Bosman rules at the time, so it was only three foreigners per squad, per team, and he had already six players, so he needed to get rid of Adji and Stoichkov. And until the last minute, was in July, I received this phone call. Everything was set up. I already picked the house in Barcelona. Everything
really?
Was... Yeah. Everything was there. We had a meeting. I played a golf tournament in Tarragona, is south of Barcelona, for his foundation. And it was the purpose of a meeting. But he didn't want the journalists and the press to think that, because it was Ruud Gullit was there, Marco van Basten and all his friends, to play in this tournament. He said, David, we use this tournament, and right after that, we go back to Barcelona in my house, and we're going to talk about next season together. Johan Cruyff, my idol when I was a kid, and telling me, you are my priority. It was just the biggest moment, one of the biggest. And so we went back and he said, I want to sign you, but I need to get rid of those players. And you sign for us. And I would tell Caspar and Núñez, the chairman at the time, that, you know, you are the priority. So I was there. And we wait until the 14th of July and receive the phone call and say, well, the players, they didn't find any club. So I'm sorry, David, but I can't sign you in the club. So I was in contract with Paris, but I didn't have Barcelona paying the transfer fee for me. So I was in Barcelona with some couple of agents, and they started to say, well, I think there's a club in England interested in you. It's Newcastle United. Kevin Keegan is in charge, Terry McDermott. Also, when I heard the name Kevin Keegan, and I said, well, that would be interesting, because it was obviously back in 1976, what games with Liverpool against Saint-Etienne. I was watching those games. This is probably when I started to realize that this is exactly what I want to do in my life, playing football at the top level. And so I said, why not? So I have a conversation with Terry McDermott. He said, we want to sign you, and da-da-da-da-da-da. And I went straight away. But it's the funny story about that is, in the middle of the night, it was 1:30 in the morning, in Amsterdam, in a very, very nice hotel. I was in my room. I received a phone call from David Dean from Arsenal.
Yeah.
Say, David, have you already signed for Newcastle? And I said, well, yes, I haven't signed yet, but I gave my word.
Yes, you promised, yeah.
To Keegan and McDermott. He said, because we want to sign you, Arsenal. And I knew, because in Paris, for 2 years, George Graham tried to sign me. But Paris always refused, because we played the Champions League, and Arsenal wanted me 4 months earlier in the season. So we were there in July, and I was sitting there, and I have David Dean on the phone saying, well, we want to sign you at Arsenal, but I gave my word, so I have to stick with that. And I said, I'm sorry, Mr. Dean, but, you know, my word is my word, and we love playing for Arsenal for you at the time. And I went to Geordieland.
How did you find Newcastle? How did you find England? And I don't mean with a compass, you know, when you got here.
You know, it's funny, because I didn't know much about England. We heard a lot about England and London and, you know, great country. And but to be honest, the Northeast and Newcastle, I didn't have a clue at the time where I was going to play with and for, actually. So when I arrived there, it was mid-July.
Good.
It was pretty cool, and you know, the people, they've been really, really nice with me. You know, in the like of Sir John Hall and
a great man,
Freddie Shepherd, all the guys involved, and Freddie Fletcher, all the people. They were very keen on the fact that that was, you know, I choose to play for them as a French player. It was a first.
So it was not the last.
not the last. That's for sure. But it was great, because I always said to myself, well, listen, this was my choice. I decided to come and play in the Premier League. But a few days before, I was linked with Celtic Glasgow, and I was in the office of Fergus McCann, and the contract was on the table, and Tommy Burns was in charge of the team as a manager.
Yeah.
And I almost signed for Celtic, and I was had the pen in my hands, the contract was on the table, and I looked at it and I said, I want to play in the English Premier League. So I went to Newcastle. It's not far away.
No,
from Glasgow.
They're quite close.
And when I arrived in Newcastle, it was just being in the unknown territory. I didn't know anything about whatsoever up there in Newcastle.
We'll come back to what you made of England, but let's talk about that first season, 95-96. In my mind, it's seared into my mind as one of the most amazing seasons in English football. Newcastle is a truly remarkable club. They haven't won anything for half a century now, but they keep bringing 50,000 people to that stadium, and that was the year they should have been champions of England.
Yeah.
The team you were in, the team you were part of, the team that you helped should have won that title.
When I first came in the dressing room, we were training in Durham, and it was on the cricket ground. We were sharing the dressing room with the University of Durham, and I was quite amazed, because in Paris we have such a great facilities in terms of professional club. When I arrived at Newcastle, it was like, I was sitting next to a player, and I remember asking Les Ferdinand, I said, Les, who is sitting next to me? Oh, I think it's a student from the university. I said, so what do you mean? We're sharing the dressing room with students. He said, yeah, well, this is a public place. And so I was coming back well, many years ago when I was amateur. And I think I really liked it because I like to bounce back all the time. And for being in Newcastle, I knew talking to Keegan or Mark Dermott or Derek Fazekele, all the staff, the people from the staff, that I was in a good place to work hard. And what I soon realized, playing with the players in training, that we had quite good players. I'm thinking about Peter Beardsley, thinking about Rob Lee, thinking about Warren Barton and Philip Albert was there, Darren Peacock, and up front it was Les, they brought in Tino Asprilla. So I really realized that we had a bunch of players who could play for something, and this is exactly what we did right from the start. All the ingredients were there to make a great club. The fans are just amazing. I remember the first away game we played was at Sheffield Wednesday. I scored my first goal, and on the way back, the lad said, "Well, let's go have a drink in town and celebrate. And David, we're going to show you how Newcastle, what Newcastle is all about."
Mm-hmm.
For the festive approach.
Yes.
And I remember going down the quayside and people throwing themselves at my feet, and I remember the guys laughing because they were watching the game in the afternoon, and they saw me. They were singing in the street, "Ginola, Ginola, Ginola," and I was, "What was going on? What was that?" And it was
people
just,
literally threw themselves at your feet.
Oh yes, they were kissing my feet. They were kissing my feet, and I said, "Come on, stand up, please, please, don't do that, don't do that." I was really. I was really shy because all this passion, all this, devotion on about just you are wearing the zebra shirt and you are part of the history of our town, our club. And I'm saying that because we don't have such things in France. We got fans, we have supporters and everything, but not with this amount of devotion and passion around.
All right, let me ask you then.
Yeah.
That fantastic team with Les scoring every week and yourself scoring every week and Philip Albert and doing what he was doing at the back. You were 12 points clear at one stage. Why didn't you win the title that year, David? I'll put it this way. I think Newcastle lost that title. Why did they lose it?
That's the same question, then.
No, you could say another great team overtook us. You lost that title.
No, I know exactly what you mean, but don't worry. I was just trying to find the right words to explain that. In terms of disappointments, I think at one stage we lost it because we didn't have the right attitude towards some of the situations during games. Like I remember the game at Liverpool, the 4-3 game we lost. We were up in the game. We scored 3 goals at Anfield. They were fighting against us, with us, to be the champion this season as well, alongside Man United. And it was complicated because some of the coaching sometimes, sometimes in the game, when it's 20 minutes, 25 minutes left in the game, you need to have, you need to see what could have changed the results in terms of the coaching.
Mm-hmm.
The coaching must be right. And sometimes we haven't defended properly, considering one stage we started conceding too many silly goals, and wasn't the case before. And we didn't have the maturity and experience to be right there. We didn't think too much. I mean, it was just we were entering the football pitch without any fear, anything. And at this stage, we start to feel the fear and the pressure on us. And it was probably when we started to play probably differently, losing games. Remember the game we lost against Man United at home? We should have been up in the game. We should have beat every single one. But it was just a lack of understanding situations. Sometimes you play differently in different situations, and we haven't done that. So it was probably the case.
David, every year in the run into the league title, they show that piece of film of Kevin Keegan saying, "And I would love it. I would love it if we beat Manchester United this title." And people always say that was a sign that Liverpool, that Newcastle were coming apart. Did the players see that, or was that a red herring, as we say?
I remember Kevin Keegan saying those words, and he was so passionate because, you know, Newcastle meant so much for him. And I think it was a shame overall, because me as a Frenchman, I was part of that. But I would have loved it, as he said.
Yeah.
As he said that for him, for the fans, for just because they think in the Northeast that people are different because they speak a very strange accent, the YI man, the things like that. And I just thought about the fans, and I was really disappointed for them more than for me, because they were so down. They were so... They couldn't understand, actually. They say, what happened? It's impossible. Why we are in this situation? We should have won it. It's difficult to explain, really, when it comes to the game itself, the points we lost on the way to end up second with 3 points behind. I mean, it's a lot of points lost. We didn't manage this period of time in this season properly. We should have been more, I would use intelligent, smart.
Newcastle, I mean, obviously they were very disappointed not to have won the title when they should have won in 95, 96. And then in that summer, you could have gone again to Barcelona. They came back for you.
Sir Bobby Robson, I was in my house in the south of France. I was relaxing after a tough season and a big disappointment of losing the title in England, obviously. And I received this phone call from Sir Bobby himself, calling me and say, "Oh, David, Bobby Robson here. Just to let you know that we're gonna make a bid on for you, Barcelona." And I said to myself, "No, well, not once again." Oh, come on. And I said, "Well, what can I say?" He said, no, I want to sign you at Barcelona." He wanted me at Barcelona. And that was, again, another tricky summer for me. I was in the mood of staying at Newcastle for a second year. I was in the mood of starting all over again, a new campaign with the club. And I was again in a situation where I'm going to have a complicated summer. And it was, because they actually contacted the club. They went from a certain amount of money towards a large amount of money on the table. And Kevin Keegan called me at one stage. He said, "David, just to let you know, that is no way. I'm telling you, no way you're going to leave the club. If I do that, I'm going to be killed by the fans. Andy Cole left the club last year, and I was almost killed by the fans, and I don't want this happen again." But I tried to let him understand that would have been a great achievement for me to end up my career in Barcelona. I was a Latin guy, and it would have been fantastic to play for a club such as Barcelona. So it was no disrespect for Newcastle, but it's opportunities. So he said, "Well, I'm just letting you know that that's a no." Well, I didn't need that, actually, because... it's like you actually putting a sweet or an ice cream in front of a kid, and you say, "You know, you see that? You see it. You will love it to have it. But you know what? You can't."
And I should tell you, David's demonstrating all this with a coffee cup full of imaginary sweets. Yeah.
And this is exactly what happened. And I'm saying that I don't want to have any disrespect for the Newcastle fans, but as a player,
sure,
with the ambition of Barcelona of being one of the best in the world, it was already one of the best clubs in the world. For a player, it's a great opportunity, especially when you reach the time towards probably more the end than the beginning. So sure. it was a shame. They put a lot of money on the table and nothing happened. So I have to start again. And Keegan left 4 months later.
There's the issue.
That's a big issue
Kevin,
for me.
Kevin having said, no, you are not going to have that.
You're going to stick with me.
You're going to stay. Kevin, the way Kevin does, bless him, leaves the club. What did you feel about that, David?
I felt at the time... I didn't understand because just before Christmas, when I heard the rumor about him leaving the club, you know, so and so, I was saying, no, you know, he asked me to stay there. No, he didn't ask me. He told me to stay, and I'm going to stay and stick with him. And I say, okay, fair enough. You know, I put my mind right, and I started the season same way I started the previous one. And he left, and it was like being stabbed in the back, if it's not too strong to say that. But it was like, and Kenny Dalglish arrived, and it was the start of a nightmare for me. So instead of playing for Barcelona and probably have a look at the future in a brighter way, I was there starting a season with Keegan, leaving it at Christmas, having a new manager. I have nothing wrong with Kenny Dalglish. He arrived. We wanted to get rid of most of the players from Keegan, and I wasn't in his plan. I can understand that. But, you know, the final bits of the season was really hard for me. So, oh, dear. Danny, you make me talk about things really, really makes me... I think it would have probably been different. But on the other hand, I'm thinking, well, if I had leave the country to play for Barcelona, I would have not played for Spurs. And it was a great great time for me playing for Spurs.
Let's finish with Newcastle. And I'm not trying to make you... All lives are made up of things that are easy to talk about and things that we'd rather perhaps put to the back of our minds, David. That's just the way it is, isn't it? You say it was a nightmare under Dalglish, but you're professional. You know that sometimes a manager comes and they just don't want... They want different kinds of players.
That's why I'm saying that I could understand.
Yeah.
I could understand that. I didn't play. I was on the bench. And I said, well, what am I doing here? I mean, it was a nightmare, you know. Well, when you're playing and you're enjoying your training days and the games, it wasn't the case anymore. Kenny Dalglish, when he arrived, he had his mind on the future of the club and working closely with Alan Shearer and players like that. But I wasn't in the plan, so I was on the bench or not playing, and it was really hard because at the time I start to think, well, it's probably time for me to go, and you know, it wasn't in the plan in first place. So it was a shame. It was difficult. But when I think about my career, certain points really annoy me a lot,
and not getting to go to Barcelona is one of those.
Yes, because we have been linked twice, and I don't know. I can't really imagine what it would have been me playing at Barcelona, but I would have probably, if with great seasons with Barcelona, have a chance to go back in the French team playing the World Cup in 98, would have changed, because I didn't play in the biggest team in the country with Manchester United, where teams like that, and I wasn't playing there. I was playing in good teams. Newcastle were good teams, wanted to be one of the best, and they were one of the best, but not the best, coming from really out of the blue. And after that, Spurs was the same.
We know you loved Newcastle and you loved your time there. And the next thing that happened to you is you end up at Spurs. Tell us how that came about.
It's funny because Jerry Francis, in charge of Spurs as manager, when my situation at Newcastle wasn't, you know, right anymore, I wanted to move, and this approach of Alan Sugar and Jerry Francis, and say, okay, but I heard things about David Ginola signing for Spurs would be a luxury. And luxury, I said, well, what does he mean? And so the explanation about what being a luxury. And I end up at Spurs. Remember being on the boat of Alan Sugar in the Bay of Villefranche, telling me about the future, what he wants to achieve at Spurs. And I end up in Chigwell at the training ground and working for Spurs and getting to know the history of the club and the past and the past players. And, you know, the good things about it is when I'm at home and I'm looking at the box holders, players, player of the year, all those great names from Teddy Sheringham, Gary Mabbutt and Chris Waddle, Glenn Hoddle, Gary Lineker, Paul Gascoigne and Jürgen Klinsmann and Saul Campbell, Darren Anderton. And I see my name three times in a row. It's the first time in the history of the club. Well, probably Gareth Bale, but I don't know. He's got three times.
Probably only two, I think.
Only two. Given so the two when you see the three lines...
Modric would have won the middle one.
Yeah, so the three lines with my name on it, surrounding by all those big names, makes me proud. Made me proud of the achievement of playing in a club that suited me a lot.
I said to you off air, and I'll say it again, if a committee of Spurs fans are sat down and designed a player for Spurs, it would be you. And you're right to say you're the only player there who's been a Spurs player of the year 3 years running in recent times, and there you are. It's a funny old time at Spurs, though, and we'll come on to the successful times in a minute. Jerry Francis came and went, then Christian Gross, a very short reign came, and I think there was the waving of the tube tickets around, but that was just for the public and the journalists. The players then went off on a pre-season tour to Switzerland, where people say he showed you a Toblerone about going up the side of it, but you were training in the mountains in Switzerland. With Christian.
Before telling this story, I want to say that during my time at Spurs, I had Jerry Francis. I had David Pleat for a short period of time. Then we had Christian Gross. Then we had Chris Hughton for a very short period of time before George Grimer. We got five different managers in 3 years. So when I talk about being a great club, great clubs need stability. And that wasn't by any means stability in
and
a club.
And they still don't do it, do they?
Anyway, so that's a funny story because we went to a training camp because he's a Swiss German.
Yes.
So we went to this training camp in Samoritz, skiing resort. Very nice. Very nice, actually. Mm-hmm. Very nice place. One morning he said, okay, guys, we're going to take a mountain bike and we're going to go through up in the mountains. And we start from the lake down in Semmeritz, going all the way up to the peak over there. And you see the snow on the mountains, and it's roughly around there. So you have 2 hours.
2 hours?
Yeah, we spent 2 hours because it's all uphill.
And not on a road?
No. It was rocks and across a river. And it was really interesting because we have plenty of time for, you know, to climb the mountains and with the mountain bikes. So, but he said, you know what, you're gonna have tough times doing that, but at the end you're gonna be rewarded for that because you're gonna have a great and a very interesting surprise. So all the way up, we were asking ourselves what the surprise will be, and finally, we finally succeed and reach the peak of our very intense climbing and riding, and we arrive in this farm with cows, on the grass, and it was surrounded by the beautiful scenery of mountains with the snow and waterfalls, and it was beautiful. And in this farm, actually, we just pass. On the side of the farm, on the other side, facing the most beautiful places, the most beautiful view ever. Well, one of the best. Mm-hmm. We got this 20-foot table buffet with full of dessert, like all the different tarts, raspberry tart, strawberry tart, creme caramel, mousse au chocolate mousse. Fruit salad, all. Can you image it? Picture in your mind a 20-foot table full of desserts.
Wonderful.
But the funny thing is, we decided with guys, we saw a waterfall on the top of the mountains, actually 50 minutes away. So we decided to climb the mountains. And the funny thing is that when we arrived there, it was a beautiful waterfall with a little pond. We decided to get naked and to go under the waterfall. But the waterfall was from the ice.
Mm-hmm.
The water from the ice is very, very cold. Yeah. So we went naked under the waterfall. But what we didn't know, back in the farm down there, there was some couples, you know, eating dessert there. Yeah. And you got these binoculars. And they were actually, they watched us having this shower under the waterfall. So when we came down, we saw this smile on the face of people, and we asked ourselves, why they are smiling? And they say, please, well, why are you so? They say, because we have been watching you having the shower under
Dave,
the waterfall.
Dave, I can't imagine that anybody would want to see your naked form under a waterfall, if I'm honest.
No, but that was funny because they said, I saw this grandma there telling me, oh, it was very interesting.
Okay, yeah. I mean, you played brilliantly for Spurs. You might tell me not all the time, but a lot of the time. For instance, everyone remembers an FA Cup quarterfinal against Barnsley. I mean, I'm going to ask you this question. You were in a better team at Newcastle, a team that's challenging for the title. You seem to be enjoying yourself a lot at Spurs.
I don't know why. To be honest, I don't know why. Sometimes you feel good in a place and you can't really explain. It's probably because I have such a great feeling with the fans. You know, sometimes you say, even now when I go back to the lane, I'm saying, well, that's my garden. I look around and I say, I feel at home. And I can't say that in every stadium. I had such a great time because my football was probably at its peak. And I realized that I was able to do some stuff on the football pitch. I only did while I was at Spurs. And that was probably why, you know, the people at Spurs, from the guy on the car park, the secretary at Chigwell, I was very close to everyone, as I am as a person, you know, because when you're part of the club, there's no the players on one side and, you know, other people on the other. I want everyone together. This is what I will do as a manager. Everyone is important in a club. And the most important thing in a club is the fan.
Very briefly, because you say it's your garden, Daniel Levy keeps talking about building a big new stadium next door to it.
That would not be my garden anymore.
I know, I see a lot of bricks. Will you be sorry if they knock down the White Hart Lane?
No, you don't have to be sorry. I think they're aiming and their goal is to be one of the greatest clubs in the country, in Europe as well. So I think they have a very... very important, massive towards the future. They want to build and create something at Spurs. And unfortunately, White Hart Lane is not in the plan. And they want a bigger things and bigger player, better player, bigger stadium, bigger everything. They got bigger infrastructure and facilities and the new training ground. Apparently, is fantastic. Never been.
I have. It's now extraordinary. They've got a bigger training ground than they have an actual football ground. So they're going to change.
You see, here we go. But I think you have to live with your time. We're talking about a time where Spurs were not a fantastic team. We didn't challenge anything. I think you're talking about the Barnsley game. And you know the thing people don't really see in this particular moment in time is when you score a goal like that, and this is something you don't know, the players, when they come to cheer things with you, you know the first thing they say? Thank you, David.
Is that right?
Yeah. I remember Justin Edinburgh, I remember Saul Campbell, I remember John Scales, Ramon Vega coming and look at me and say, thank you, David. Thank you. And you know what? I think it's probably the best reward you can get as a player when your teammate coming to say thank you.
You got further rewards in 1999. You win a trophy with Spurs at Wembley in the League Cup. You are the double footballer of the year. Let's take those in order. The League Cup final at last, a medal in English football.
Yes. I was talking about individual awards and, mm-hmm. and team awards, mm-hmm. and this is the kind of things. Playing at Wembley was fantastic.
With George Graham, of course, by this time. Yeah.
George Graham, Tottenham Hotspurs, playing against Leicester in the final. All the preparation of... I think it was great because we end up on the high and as a club, and I think it was important. And this win meant a lot for all of us, including the fans, including every single one at the club. Because even if we knew we didn't have a team to challenge anything, we end up with something. We end up with something to be proud of. And we won this League Cup. Obviously, I was player of the year and writers player of the year, and I end up on the transfer list. And I think, you know, I was talking to George Graham the other morning with Alan Brazier on the phone. Mm-hmm. I don't have any, I don't know how to say it in English, but I don't have any rancune.
Rancor or animosity.
Or animosity, yeah. Towards anyone, because I think life has given me so much since a young boy. You know, I always think about this young boy of 9 years old watching the game on the couch at home with his dad and watching the games and say, "Dad, you know what? This is what I want to do, by the way." And my dad looking at me and I say, "What do you mean?" I want to be a footballer. This is what I want to do. I say, "Yeah, okay, but you go at school, work on your homework, do your homework and things." But, "Dad, you don't understand. This is exactly what I want to do in my life." So now I retired 10 years ago. Football somehow is behind me as a player. Mm-hmm. I would love to be a manager. I mean, I tell you why I would love to be a manager, because it is probably the only way you can be as close as you were as a player and to the game. The approach of the game, are you going to change that? And I would love to find a chairman out there, to be honest, who give me the key of the club and say, "David, I know exactly what you think and your thoughts on football. I love that. I want you to be a success with me. I leave you the key for 5 years. Make the best of what I've given you." And this is, I will do more than my best to bring the most amazing attitude towards the game and towards the fans, towards anything has to do with football. I will make sure that every single player, we really understand where they are and what they have to achieve with us. Every single bits and pieces I would love to see in football. And I think the only way to do so is to be a manager.
David, we still have more of your career to go. Spells at Aston Villa and Everton. But you never wanted to leave Spurs, did you?
Never. I wanted to end up my career at Spurs. But unfortunately, one day... I received this weird phone call from Sir Alan Sugar. I was in Spain on his boat, and he called me and he said, "David, I got some bad news. George Graham wants you out. He wants you to leave the club. He wants to put you on the transfer list." And so I end up on the transfer list, and I end up in a situation where I had to think about leaving the club. So, unfortunately, I have to say that because some of the Spurs fan didn't really know about what happened, I never asked for anything. I was just doing some on holiday in Mauritius. I met Doug Ellis, and he said, "David, we love you at the club," and we started like that. We finished the conversation on that, and on my way back, I had to make a decision while staying at Spurs, because I was under contract with Spurs, saying to George Graham, "No, I'm not going to." But I didn't want to fight. I didn't want to fight with him. I didn't want to end up in a situation, because I knew that this man could be really tough, could be really tough on me. And I didn't want that towards the end of my career. So I'd rather go to a place where the people, you know, really embraced me and wanted me at the club, while staying in the club, why someone doesn't want you anymore. So if to stay on the bench. And I thought also about me, David Ginola. Sorry, I don't like to talk about, mm-hmm. to use this bit. David Ginola on the bench. at White Hart Lane, while he's putting Etherington or anyone on a thing, I was thinking about the fans booing and whistling George Graham because I was stuck on the bench. I think it would have been a weird situation. I didn't want that for Spurs and for the fans. I just wanted to move on and think about other things. So that's why I moved to Villa. Complicated with John Gregory. John Gregory was terrible with me. I mean, it was really complicated. And I started to realize, oh, I was well at Spurs. It was a great club for me. And while I didn't stay there, and it was difficult. There's no disrespect for the villains and the fans at Villa, but John Gregory wasn't the right person for the club. And I ended up at Everton, and I start to realize that it was probably it. It was the end of my career. It was just to think about it's probably time to stop and to think about something else. Go back to the south of France, stay sometimes with my mom. And I think I did it right because my mom passed away a few months later. And my kids and myself, we took time to spend time with her. It's... it was really an emotional time because this is what life is all about. You need to spend time with the people you love, and sometimes you think that life will be forever and people will live forever, and you have plenty of time to spend with them, and so it's actually not true. And because I'm very sensitive as well, I start to realize that I was good to stay sometimes with the person you love the most in life.
Well, I'm glad you told me that, because I was going to ask you a question about, did you feel that the last couple of years of your career slipped away after you'd been Footballer of the Year in 1999?
It was a nightmare, Danny. It was a nightmare. It was a nightmare. Being left on the bench, waking up on a Saturday, going to a game, seeing the back page of the Sun with David Ginola is Mr. Blobby, and you got your face on the body of Jimmy Five Billies, and saying you're overweight and you're fat and you're all this and that, and you work so hard to stay fit at 35 years old. It was terrible, and it was just amazing. I will never treat as a manager of players. You have to get the respect back. You need to respect people. It's not only in the football club. It's in life in general. You know, I can walk in any places in England right now. I can go. I was at the Emirates yesterday night. I was in any clubs. People are not saying any bad words towards me. There's only great things. And I'm probably one of the kind that I can walk around any stadiums in this country without any fear of encountering you know, naughty stuff. And it's just amazing, because as a man, I always wanted to get this respect back. So if you do respect people, they will give the respect back to you. And it should work like that. So with John Gregory, I had these funny moments. I worked a little bit with David Moyes at Everton as well. So it was complicated, because your mind is not there anymore. And I was thinking about Spurs, and honestly, you know, I was talking to George Graham on the phone the other day, and in my head I said, when he arrived at the club, I had probably my best year in football under George Graham.
The players thought you were the best player in the country.
He was also the one who pushed me through the door. And that's... difficult to explain, because you say, I'm going to work very hard to prove him wrong. You've been a great player for him. You've been a great man in a dressing room for him. You've been a great person towards him as well when he was ill and he was in the hospital. And it was me calling him in the hospital saying, Mr. Graham, we're going to win the game for you, and you can count on me. And a few months later, pushing me through the door and putting me on the transfer list is a lack of respect. So sometimes you realize in life, that's what is all about. When it comes to respect, what is all about life?
Football is brutal. It is just a very brutal sport. But I guess what I was going to say was, and I don't want to be too sentimental here, In some ways, the way your career ended, it gave you the time to be with your mum. So maybe there was something working in your favour there, David.
Yeah, but somehow, I mean, after a few years, I realised that I could have played more because I didn't get any bad injuries.
No.
I was able to carry on, but mentally, I had some very tough people around me who pushed me through the door and thinking about, I can't stay there anymore. I love working with people like Sir Alex Ferguson or people who really give a lot of credit and respect towards the players and take time to understand the players, to know. If I will be a manager one day, you know, I don't want to have all the shit I had in the past. I will be the most amazing manager. Listen to me. It's no words. I will prove it. I will be the most amazing manager towards my chairman, towards the board, towards my players, towards the fans, towards everyone in the single club. I will make sure that everyone will be, you know, everybody will be only one.
Since you retired, you've done acting and modelling. Everyone makes a laugh about your hair adverts and all the rest of it, particularly those of us with less hair than you. And you work on BT, being a pundit. And I know back in France, of course, in your native language, you're a fantastically well-regarded pundit. Where are you in your life now? What do you hope for in the future? I mean, clearly you want to get back into football as a manager. You've said so, but...
Very simple, Danny. When I retired from the game in 2002, I was so... down with the people I met in the last few years of my career that I started to think, well, just get away from everything. So I had a break and I'd done nothing at all for 7 years. So until I decided with the entire family to come back in 2009 and to England, live in London and doing some work, pass my badges. I'm in the process of that, working for TalkSport with Alain Brazil every Wednesday morning.
Bless you.
Grand Best give me the opportunity to work for BT Sport, the new channel. And I think I feel really good at BT Sport. And, you know, it's a very good way to work. The approach of football is great. And I've got some opportunities and looking at the future, doing something different, working for Canal Plus as well in France, and still have a lot of idea, a lot of things I want to do, I want to achieve. But most of all, if I can get back in the game, as I said, with someone, because you can't, as a manager, work without a chairman giving you the key of the club. And this is the most, it's about... confiance is about trust, is about faith. You need to feel this. This is a kind of feeling. You don't, sometimes you feel things. Sometimes you meet someone and you say, well, I think I'm quite worried about this one, but it's a mixed feeling. And I need to have this sort of working partnership where you can find this. And I need that in my life on a daily basis. I have this with BT Sport, with Grand Best. I have this here with the people I'm working with at TalkSport. I have this at Canal Plus, and this is my kind of way of doing my best when I know that I'm working with people that love me.
You've been listening to an archive edition of TalkSport's My Sporting Life with Danny Kelly. Thanks for listening. And make sure you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Acast, and Spotify for more top TalkSport content.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.